The first person from Bozeman I ever heard of was Chris Cunningham of the duo Chris and Johnny, now called Story Hill, performing then in Northfield, Minnesota. In this episode from Stephen Harris Wheel's interview series, You Are Admirable, you will hear how Chris began his musical career, starting from performing a talent night at Bozeman High School, to recording his first songs with John Hermanson in 1987, to getting invited to Prairie Home Companion and elsewhere. We also hear about his efforts to manage his recording and production business, about how, as a kid, he accidentally started his house on fire when his parents were away, and about his spiritual interest in crop circles. Chris tells about his recent cancer scare and his choice to seek unconventional treatment for it. As usual, this is an edited version of the longer interview, which you can find at Stephen's website, youareadmirable.com.
Hi, everyone. Stephen here, and welcome to episode number 15 of You Are Admirable. Today, our guest is Chris Cunningham. Chris is a singer-songwriter, musician, music producer. He's also a father, husband, and a friend. He's such a talented person. He's got great stories, and I'm excited to share this interview with all of you. Let's jump into it. Well, Chris, I have the opportunity to be interviewing now because my friend nominated you as somebody he admires. And the thing that he said is he admires you not only as a great singer-songwriter in creating unpretentious, very relatable music, but he also admires you as a person and specifically the life that you've made for yourself. Mm-hmm. So being able to live off of being a musician, off of writing music, off of producing music, off of performing, having a very nice family, having your own studio. Mm-hmm. And the question that he really had for you is that something that you envisioned for your life? And now that you're here, how do you feel about being where you're at?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Wow. Well, first of all, that's so cool that he thought of me. That's neat. I mean, I'm touched. Yeah. And, it's, I don't know, it's just kind of touching to get that perspective, you know, that feedback from the universe, so to speak, from somebody else's eyes. That's like, wow, cool. Because, you know, I can go along in my own tunnel vision and sort of not sort of count my blessings, you know, I can forget. But yeah, the vision for, you know, actually this house and this kind of lifestyle with running a recording studio business and being in a family, it all kind of came together pretty clearly in my late 20s, early 30s. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just kind of like a pretty rapid unfoldment. And yeah, what do I feel about it now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you satisfied with it?
Yes and no. I mean, there's aspects that I would, that are challenging, that I just sort of ongoing things I would like to tweak and believe I can over time. One of them just being more time for creating, you know, like I had all the time in the world in my 20s, you know. Because in my 20s, it was just full-time life on the road, yeah. You know, and no, you know, spouse or anybody to be, you know, totally committed to and responsible to. And it's just like, you know, and the fulfillment part of being married and with, you know, and a parent way outweighs the, you know, the challenges, but there's definitely a whole different mindset that I didn't know was going to happen. Yeah. And it's not all about me anymore. And that's good, you know? I mean, and as time goes on, I actually find kind of some joy in that too. Yeah. You know, it's like, oh, I can enjoy watching someone else like grow, you know, and learn. I mean, our son's in a real rapid learning phase right now. Not that he hasn't been the whole time, but there's a lot of fulfillment in being a parent and a husband. Yeah. And yeah, and the whole package. I mean, I still feel pretty optimistic overall about all of it, you know. Like, this has been 12 years now. I've been full-time running Basecamp, recording, and the fact that people continue to, you know, come back after, you know, repeat clients, that's pretty cool. And the kind of the level of feedback I get from people is on average really high. You know, they seem to appreciate, you know, their experience working with me. So,
yeah.
So that keeps me satisfied for sure.
Nice.
You know, and Kyle mentioned that on the unpretentious songs, that's kind of how I feel too about the producing. It sounds like such a glamorous word, but really it's a service word. I'm just here to try to help other people, you know, in however which ways occur to me, help them get, you know, do something magical with what they've got. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be compared to anybody else, you know, just draw out the best in them and hopefully add to it.
You still have somehow remained a very humble and pleasant and just a good guy, very cool guy.
That's great.
And I mean, I've read a bunch of quotes and testimonials about you too, and it seems to be like that's pretty much the consensus, that you're a very humble person who also cares a lot about getting the right product for people too, as far as producing their music. And I'm wondering specifically if humility and that kind of open-hearted caring, if you think that comes from somewhere in particular.
I mean, I think it's, I mean, it's probably from my upbringing, you know, to some extent, but, you know, I think it's probably more about my nature in a way. I mean, I feel like I'm in general a pretty, what do you call it? Like kind of harmonious, you know, sort of accepting person, mm-hmm. non-judgmental, yeah. You know, for the most part, especially when it comes to, you know, interactions with, you know, people I'm sort of viewing as like, it's my job to help them, other artists or musicians or work with them. I tend to be, you know, pretty instinctually collaborative, you know. This isn't about me trying to, like, you know, whatever, make my mark using somebody else's stuff. That's more, you know, maybe what you find in other places or other sort of producers, who maybe, you know, maybe have more of like a need for recognition or something, you know, like gotta have my electric guitar sound on, you know, half of the tracks or something. But like that pursuit of sort of fame and recognition has never occurred to me much.
Yeah.
It's like, to me, it's like, I just want to feel inspiration, you know, that's kind of what drives me. It's like, you know, something is feels good or, you know, then I'll, like that was the same with me in the Story Hill careers, which is still going, but I mean, 30 years of doing, you know, quite a bit of music with another Bozemanite, you know, John Hermanson, or Johnny as I know him. You know, we were different a little bit in the sense that of the two of us, you know, I was just kind of like along for the ride in a way. I was like, yeah, I love to sing, you know, I love to travel. And Johnny was more like, well, we need to, you know, set goals, we need to, you know, and I respect that too, and so in a way we complement each other pretty well, but it's just, I'm illustrating the difference, like a lot of people are more ambitious than me, and I'm a little more like, I don't know, let's see what's happening today.
Yeah, yeah. Nice.
Yeah, and not that I don't have vision and have had stretches of sort of you know, wanting to pursue an ambition or an ambitious goal for sure. I mean, I know it takes some, you know, follow through to make things happen, but Your question about, caring about the product and stuff, I think once I get involved and get personally invested in something, it's like, then I can't help but care, you know? And like, it really doesn't matter to me what the music is or where the person's skill sets are, so to speak, if they're really great or if they're just okay. If I can see that their heart is in it and they're passionate about something, that it just like the personal fulfillment thing is there, that's what I key into. And you know, and a lot of the people I work with, it's about that for them. It's really, and so it ends up being better than they would have expected, because then they have this extra help, you know, because I kind of do have quality standards, I guess I'd say, you know, at some point. I mean, I might politely, you know, direct them towards something like, hey, it's not happening today, you know, I don't feel it, but I know it can come out. How about we try this again tomorrow? That kind of suggestion. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really appreciated by people who want the best. It's not oftentimes what you want to hear or what you're expecting, but it needs to be said. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
With a lot of the things that we're just kind of talking about, it kind of dovetails into the question I always ask everybody, and it's what do you think is your most admirable trait or characteristic, and what do you think is your least admirable trait or characteristic, or something you'd like to improve?
Yeah, well, in reverse order, the least one is a tendency to waste time, be a procrastinant, you know, to maybe have good intentions, but you know, you know, there's kind of a lot to be said about that.
That's good to hear, because I feel like you've accomplished a lot. And I feel like I'm a procrastinator too, and it's like, oh, I haven't accomplished a lot. So hearing it from you is like, all right.
Good. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's an ongoing, you know, awareness to work with, because, well, what I ideally want to be able to do is, you know, you've heard the motto, you know, like promise, you know, by a certain point, but shoot for sooner.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, like quote them higher, but try to get it under, kind of thing, as far as cost and stuff. And practically speaking, it doesn't really pan out that way, but it's a good guy on the whole, but it's a good thing to kind of an ethic to live by, you know, and that way I can keep in communication with clients and prevent, you know, disastrous disappointments and stuff. But yeah, that's been, not just in my business, but like just in my whole life, you know, the rest of the other aspects of my life, like even just being a homeowner, you know, there's just so many parts of the house, my house, the home, that I'm just like, when am I going to get to that one thing that I've had this inspiration about years ago, you know? So on and on like that. The garden's a good example. I really want a greenhouse.
Oh, nice.
And I kept thinking, well, I'll just start small. And like even this winter, I was going to plant some stuff in pots and just have it here in the sunlight. And I still could. It's still winter out there.
Right.
It's probably a perfect time. But yeah, that's definitely one of them. And I have gotten myself into some, challenging relational things with, you know, people kind of wishing that things had gone quicker, clients and stuff. I'm learning, you know. Like, for example, like, as a solo business guy, you know, I got to learn how to pace and not take on more than I can handle, for one thing, and also plan ahead for when there aren't people calling for, you know. And so the navigating the ups and downs of self-employment has been a fun little dance. Interesting dance. And and as far as like the positive, I just think that, you know, in sort of a musical terms, my ability to sing harmonies and to harmonize musically with other people. I mean, that's one of my gifts, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I love it. I mean, it's just come naturally, you know, and I could forever love to sort of be Garfunkel to someone, Simon, you know. You know, at the same time, you know, that's not the only place I want to be, of course, musically. And I enjoy, I don't want to be boxed in. I enjoy branching out from that a lot. And then translate that into studio work and producing with others. Again, it's just the ability to be more collaborative than dictatorial or directive, you know.
Nice, yeah.
Yeah, I try to find out, you know, what people are, you know, where they're at emotionally and try to help them feel at ease and try to kind of establish like a connection and then nurture a relationship, because that's really what we're doing, is spending, you know, multitudes of hours working together on their most sacred thing.
Yeah.
So I want to be, you know, I say a little prayer before anyone walks in the door and every day, just to try to be aligned with that intention, you know.
Nice.
Yeah.
Would you be willing to share that little prayer?
It's just basically, you know, it's like, it can just be in my head, but it's just basically, you know, God, make me, you know, help me be of service to, you know, service minded here today. It can be really quick, just so I'm remembering that I'm being intentional, and I'm like, I've got the on switch on, you know, and I'm not sleeping in my own, you know, personal world when they're in. You know,
nice. Yeah. Nice. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to probably co-opt that to my intentionality as well.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny, because it, even when I don't feel like that, like I'll wake up some days and just be like, you know, I've got no go-go juice or motivation. Once I'm able to do that and then get in it, like I get into stuff way quicker.
Yeah.
You know, and then sort of like fears and worries and concerns just kind of dissipate, and the joy of working with somebody else like just magnifies. It just kind of comes alive. And I've gotten feedback from people saying how nervous they were at first or something, to, you know, sit down and, oh my God, microphones, oh my God, the pressure of recording, and oh my God, I thought I had to have this, I thought I practiced this enough, it was supposed to, you know, I was supposed to be ready, you know. And it's just like, you know, all that kind of settles down when they know they've got someone on their side through the process, you know.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it nice. Helps me, because I don't like to deal with, you know, too much anxiety. I've had people break down in tears before, and, you know, the thing to do then is realize it's, you know, something's going on inside. There's emotions, and, you know, some of their music is maybe triggering, and they're not quite done with emoting about it, you know. And so you just make the space, sometimes just sit and wait, sometimes be a friend, you know, and whatever. And, you know, I don't know, it just, that kind of thing is, I don't know, it's just, that's part of life, you know. It's not all about getting a product.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's really cool. You mentioned your harmonizing talent, and I think, you know, listening to your solo album and listening to you at different things, like, I love hearing your voice, and especially, like, lyrically, you're extremely talented, I think. And I was looking through some bio stuff and about you and how you're multi-instrumental and all the instruments you play. I also saw, did you start out on trumpet in high school then? Okay. So that's what started it all.
It did, yeah.
That's awesome. Do you have a favorite instrument?
Probably voice.
Okay.
Yeah, if I really think about it. I mean, if, like, right off the top of my head, singing is... It doesn't, because it's so, you know, the visceral and resonant, experiential, you know. Yeah, probably my voice is my favorite. And then, you know, I love to play piano. That was my very first sort of music-making creative instrument.
Okay.
You know, and that's when I started singing, was, in fact, Story Hill used to be called Chris and Johnny back in our high school days at Bozeman High. And long before Hawks Night Live was something they called Candlelight Dinner,
okay,
or the Candlelight Music Night. And that was in the cafeteria where all the parents were invited in. And people in the choirs were, you know, given a chance to sing one song. And there'd be candles up and some, you know, terrible PA, maybe like a PV or something, whatever they could find. And Johnny and I were in choirs together, and he and I were the first that we knew of to do our own original, perform our own original songs. You know, everybody else was doing like, you know, Seven Bridges Road or Here Comes the Sun or something. And all that was good, but we wanted to, we were probably about 16 at that time, you know, sophomores or something. And the kind of sort of feeling that we got from doing that was more electric, you know, like people were really like, wow, you know, something. There was like a surge of like admiration, just like, you guys did great, you know, you wrote that and sang, you know, that, yeah. And I played piano for that little stretch of the first couple of years.
Nice.
But you can't carry a piano around, and
electric,
Johnny was like, why don't you learn guitar? Okay, I'll try.
That's really how it happened. I was just like, you should learn guitar.
Yeah, he started learning guitar at church camp. It's called Christicon. In the summertime, I remember his, friend, mentor that taught him the first handful of chords. And then he came back after summer, and he was singing original songs along with other ones. But and it was like, because he was a violin, like, kind of a great violin player, you know, one of those first chair kind of guys. I think he was, or second. And but the guitar came naturally to him. And then I spent the summer at my church camp. I was working there, so I had a 12 string. So a friend of my parents, I don't know, they just bought me a 12 string, which are the hardest things to learn on. So I was like fisting these like giant G chords, and you know, I could only play like three or four because you can't bar a chord on those.
Yeah.
You know, they're really hard. But then by the time I got to six, it was like, oh, this is easier. Yeah.
Why don't I start with this?
Yeah. This is great. And so the guitar, I love to play it, but I've always used the guitar more for, you know, carrying a song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's a big distinction in my mind between players and singer-songwriters, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and how much, like, a singer-songwriter can kind of decide for themselves to what extent they want to incorporate their, you know, an auxiliary instrument besides their lyrics. And what, to me, the main thing is you write a song and you sing it and you find a way to, you know, to a vehicle like a guitar or a piano to deliver it. Yeah. A cappella singing is pretty boring. But add some nice guitar and stuff. That works.
That's an interesting process. I like that. With the original songs that you've made, is there one in particular that you're kind of most satisfied with or is most meaningful to you?
Well, there's one that is that I recognize as being the most meaningful to I guess it's meaningful to me, but it's like it has the biggest life of its own. And it's one that seems to be like kind of the Story Hill anthem in a lot of ways. It's like it's kind of requested for, you know, ever since we played it, which is, I think it's, and recorded it in the mid-90s. It's called Steady On. Mm-hmm. And it's got this uplifting message, and it also musically it moves to a crescendo, you know, like this sort of bridge over troubled water kind of, you know, level of rise, and then it just soars at the end, right? Literally, it, the image is, you know, geese flying in formation, chevron formation, you know, V formation, and it's the lyrics are really hopeful. They're about sort of self empowerment or, you know, acceptance and stuff. And so, you know, it seems like, you know, all across our concert history, and then just, you know, no matter what we've done sort of as a, you know, the changes we've kind of got, we went from sort of folk or even Christian-y folk to more singer-songwriter, urban, and into, you know, maybe more, I don't know, just refined folk in some ways. But, like, that song has sort of stayed as a mainstay. Like, even if we don't include it in the set, it just, it gets done at the end of the night.
Nice.
And, yeah. And it appeals to people of all ages, you know. So it's one of those that kind of has, like, no class distinction or age distinction. Whatever, it just works.
Yeah, anybody can connect with it.
Yeah. So, I mean, but as far as my own, like, favorite songs, there might be another little category for
me. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm curious if there's, I think Kyle runs into this with his song making too every now and then, where he will create a song which he really loves, and it just doesn't get the response from other people.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there's maybe one in particular that you're just like, this song I love and I think is so great. Yeah. And it didn't perform, I guess, as expected when you brought it out to the world.
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple of those that don't even leave the living room, you know, because I'm still waiting for my wife to cheer or something. I don't know. Don't you love this song? It's my favorite mellow, you know, song that I've ever written. You know, I can sing it like at whisper level and it still rocks, you know, and that's why I like it. But yeah, there's a couple few. And I tacked one of them on to the end of my latest solo EP. Mm-hmm. All right, you know, and I attempted to. I don't know that it turned out that it was my best performance of it, but it's really just simple guitar and simple lyric, a lot of imagery and stuff like that that isn't like sort of like hooky or, you know, it's not in some kind of, it just originated, mm-hmm. you know, and it's on its own. And that's the kind of songs that they come from somewhere else for me. And it's like, wow, I feel kind of lucky to have whatever gotten this thing. Yeah.
What song title is that?
The one I'm, which one am I referring to? The one that's recorded?
Yeah.
Spanish Dove. Yeah. And I wrote that my first year out of high school. I was living in Spain.
Right.
Studying in Spain. 89. In 89, yeah. And that's why I wrote Spanish Dove, you know, quote, parentheses, circa 89. Somewhere there or 90, you know. And I was writing a lot that year because, you know, like I said, you know, I had a lot of time in my youth or younger adult years. You know, you'd go to, like, life in Spain, we were talking about getting rest and stuff. I mean, you had siesta. Everybody had siesta for 2 hours, 3 hours in the afternoon and sit around with a guitar.
Yeah.
You know, and the world was pretty quiet. And then my responsibilities were just, like, studying and getting to class the next day. somebody else was, I hooked up with a friend, and we shared an apartment, and we're friends to this day. He loved to cook, and I loved to play guitar, and he loved to listen. And I mean, we would still be roomies today if things were different. Because, and he's a pro chef now, and in just like me, he's self-employed, does his own catering, and lives in Austin, which is his music capital. Well, that's where he's from, but
yeah.
You know, and anyway, and so he was a great source of encouragement, you know, nice. And was just always, like, cooking food and putting stuff on the table while I was sitting at the table playing.
That's great. Who do you think has been the most influential person in your life?
Well, I mean, as far as musically, if that's what we're talking about.
We can say musically and we can say period.
Well, okay, so the music one is Johnny Hermanson.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I wouldn't be where I'm at if I hadn't, you know, like Bermuda triangled into some kind of relationship with Johnny. And he was the first one to sort of call me out and say, you know, that's great original song. You know, I didn't even know. My first songwriting was more like just little prayers and things for myself and stuff. And prior to that, it was like learning. Like I said, I used to play piano a lot just to kind of calm down at the end of the day. Go down to my parents' house. I was living with my parents. I'd go down to their basement and basically meditate on the piano and sing. Like, I started to open up songbooks by Joni Mitchell and Jim Croce and people that I was hearing. My parents would play their records and stuff. And I liked melody and ballads, and so I could play those. And I started learning other people's songs and... But then I started, like, sort of writing my own. And like I said, Johnny was, I remember being, visiting his house, his parents' house on South 3rd, over by campus, and playing this song. He asked, he was like, I'd really like to hear your song. And we were just sitting on his front porch or their front porch. And I played it real, like, you know, shy. And he's like, God, yeah, that, you wrote that? That's great. Do you mind if I try singing along with it? And that's when it started. And then pretty soon there were like neighborhood kids like gathering around, you know, from across the street and stuff. Pretty soon time stood still and we were just like making music, you know. And then we kept doing it like on our own volition. We're like, let's do it again. And so... we made our first recording of original songs together one winter, in like 1987 or something. Like, we were freshmen, sophomores, something like that, with like a Fostex four tracker down in his parents' basement, making like reverb effects through the Fender amp and stuff. And a lot of the songs were really, you know, they didn't have a lot of form, or they just had these very sort of ethereal lyrics and stuff. But it was our thing. Yeah. So he was the first one to encourage me to, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but to become a singer-songwriter, an active one. And then he was the first one to book our first gig. Our first public appearance was at this coffee shop. What was it called? It used to be on campus, actually, over where Town and Country is now. And this was a long time ago.
It wasn't a different Leaf and Bean, was it?
No. And I mean, given a chance, I can see the poster because one of our friends, in my mind,
yeah.
One of our friends like made an 8.5 by 11 caricatures of us, Chris and Johnny, you know, $5. I don't know if it said cover or donation or something. But we packed the house, you know,
yeah.
And we only had enough for like half a set. And then the rest were like John Denver and U2 covers, you know. but we got encored and I was scared out of my mind. I can barely remember it. You know, I was such an introvert and totally like afraid of people listening and, you know. Yeah,
that's awesome. Do you have a favorite song that's not yours?
A bunch. I have a favorite handful of artists that I would say.
Nope, doesn't count.
Uh-huh.
Favorite song.
Favorite
one.
Song.
Yeah.
I gotta say, I love "Bridge Over Troubled Water."
Okay.
Because it's. It's like a hymn to me. It's like a gospel song. It's like there's an energy to that. And not too many people can sing it. In fact, in my mind, it's just Garfunkel.
Wow.
which is kind of amazing that Simon wrote it, Garfunkel sings it. And but apart from that, it's just the feeling of it. It's like it's such good medicine, you know. Like it's like a it's like how I want to I wish more music was like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just really healing. Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks for that.
Compassionate song. Mm-hmm.
And back to who do you think has been the biggest influence on your life outside of music?
And apart from my wife, right?
Yep.
And parents.
Actually, no, not apart from them.
Oh.
That's the last question. So that's, you can absolutely nominate.
Yeah.
Well, not nominate, but you can absolutely answer with any of them.
Well, my wife, Leslie, yeah, Leslie Rickard turned Cunningham. Yeah, she keeps me, you know, going sort of straight down a path, you know, as far as like having some kind of inspiration for improving and growing, you know, and handling adversity. And, you know, I mean, there's just so much to be said about, you know, my feeling lucky or fortunate to, you know, to have the gift of her commitment. And just, you know, it's not always easy, of course, for her or me, but, you know, the marriage path with her has been, I couldn't imagine life, my life without doing that. She's really brought out the best in me and supported. And I hope to think, I mean, yeah, it's mutual. Like, I think we kind of, that was one of the big things that brought us together was like, well, what inspires you? Well, what inspires you? Well, let's talk more about that, you know, and like kind of just support it.
Chris, of everything that you do, with producing, playing, do you still ski?
I would love to ski. Yeah, not much.
All right, with everything that you do in your life, you know, being a father, being a husband, music, producing, what's your favorite thing to do?
I still love to sing and play, but really it's tied or probably eclipsed by being a father and a parent with my wife, with him. I mean, those joys just seem to keep escalating. I don't know why, or if that's just normal.
Yeah.
Yeah, natural. 'Cause I think what's happening for me is that, you know, there's a bit of a priority shift. I remember my dad saying, you know, his list of priorities for himself were, you know, well, to put it his way, is like, you know, Chris, you should ask yourself the following questions, like, where do you want to live? What do you want to do? Who do you want to live with? You know, and kind of like put them in the order that feels right. And, you know, I was all over the map for a long time. Like after high school, all I wanted to do was travel. So I went to Spain and then another foreign country called Minnesota. And then I hit the road for 5 years and just crisscrossed the country with Johnny for, you know, in a Dodge minivan, caravan. And so I got to see a lot of the states. And I got to spend some time in Pittsburgh or near there doing some volunteer construction and made a little community there. And then I got to go live in Seattle for like almost a year. But then I came back to visit Bozeman. And my sort of running joke is I'm still here visiting because that was like close to 20 years ago. Actually, it was 20 years ago. And so I've started a new life. And so when I hit Bozeman, I was like, felt like I was home again, you know. Mm-hmm. My soul just like went to rest here. And, you know, it rested. And I was ready in my, you know, to sort of establish roots and kind of, you know, do something that wasn't so tied to motion. being in a different place every day. And being so tied to one other person, you know, with in a musical duo. And like I mentioned earlier, you know, that difference, Johnny was very driven. So in order to kind of keep up with them, I had to sort of ignore a lot of my natural instincts. And I started craving community and, you know, other relationships and stuff. And, and then, you know, when I met Leslie, it was like who I wanted to live with. And, you know, yeah, I still wanted to do music, but I could kind of put that third, you know. And then the way around that was, well, maybe if you build a recording studio, you could keep being musical. So that's been the sort of substitute, which has turned into more of a real thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now I like to branch out from the studio and go play at Bozeman Hot Springs or Ted's or... You know, I get calls to go play house concerts around the area, and someone just called from North Carolina, and that would be my second time being flown out to their house concert.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool, yeah.
You know, and someone in Boise just called, and they're like, can we fly you out? And I'm like, well, let's figure out a time. I got to work around, you know, school schedule. Stuff like that, but yeah, those, yeah. I can't remember exactly what the question was.
Oh, it was just, what's your favorite thing? Yeah. And then the next question after that is, what accomplishment are you most proud of?
Oh, gosh. Well, one of the things I wrote down when you sent me the list of questions, there's kind of like two or three that tied for in terms of music. But probably the best thing was with Story Hill getting to get on a Prairie Home Companion and getting that, you know, repeated invitations to play on the show.
Oh, yeah.
For one, and then getting invited onto their these cruise ships with, you know, Prairie Home Companion cruise ships. And the first one was great. But the second one was amazing. It was in the Bahamas. And I got to take, you know, my wife and son and Johnny and his wife. And then both sets of our parents bought tickets. And so, you know, spending 8 days on the seas and I grew up with, you know, his folks too. You know, I spent a lot of time with them. So we'd have dinner every night. And I just love being on the water. So it was like the best package, you know, for me, like sunshine, play music, couldn't ask for more. It was great.
That's awesome.
I don't know if that's an accomplishment or just some fun thing that I get, you know.
Yeah, being good enough to be invited and play on that. Absolutely.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
That's great. You said it was tied with two other things other than Prairie Home?
Well, I'd say raising, you know, being a father, being a parent is the other one. And then getting invited onto 11th and Grant was pretty awesome.
Yeah, that seems like it was a cool experience.
It was really cool. And getting to play with, you know, I was really honored to do it. And yet, like, to get the invitation direct from Eric. And but I also knew that, like, I would probably be too freaked out to just do it solo. So it was an opportunity to ask a few other friends if they'd, and, you know, two of them I knew for a long time, but one, you know, I ended up with a band. So putting together a little string band was like so cool.
That's awesome.
So, yeah.
What's something about you that most people wouldn't know?
Well, I was going to say, I used to have a really strong interest in, something that most people don't know about, but crop circles. Have you heard of those?
Yes. Go on.
Okay. So when I was living in Seattle, I was taking a year off I had decided to stop touring and being with, you know, Johnny and I had kind of mutually arrived like, okay, that was a great 5 years. And I was burned out. Mm-hmm. And I was still, like, kind of searching, you know, like, spiritually or whatever. And I figured I'd find something in Seattle. I don't know. And I spent quite a bit of time just like soaking in the offerings of different things there. And when I started, like, I don't know, going to lectures or work, you know, anyway, when I stumbled on what the heck are crop circles, I got really like intrigued, and I started studying as much as I could. This is kind of the early internet days, so you know, there were crop circle enthusiasts, especially over in the UK, because that's where most of them were appearing, the longer growing season there, and the more open-minded English culture. They were really, first of all, they were everywhere in England, especially in the UK, all those islands. But there were people that were like really, really like documenting them and trying to figure out what was going on, and theorizing and stuff, and updating. Like, there were people that were self-funded pilots, you know, who once they were spotted, they'd fly over and photograph and then upload those and do what they could to document the data and stuff. But I got into it in more of like a spiritual way. I was like, wow, what, you know, and it really led to a lot of inspiration for me at that time in my life. I felt like this connection to something, you know, greater and you know, like we are not alone kind of thing, something benevolent. I felt this that they were signs and that they were, you know, they were something, you know, positive within intention, you know, for the most part. Yeah. So
how do you feel about them now?
I feel like they were a big part of my, you know, awakening or whatever, early awakening, spiritual awakening. Yeah, to that connection that again, like, we're not alone, and maybe we are one kind of feeling, you know, and there's something active in this, in what we call our universe, you know. So, and you know, I've never been one to get tripped up or stumble on the ones that are human made, just because it's just. So clear the difference between something that's basically smashed down with crude instrument boards and ropes and stuff, jokes and hoax.
Yeah.
And the difference between those and like ones that are created within, you know, 30 seconds, that are half a mile long and perfect geometric shapes, and where the crop is still, you know, alive, living, and stays that way, and they can be in the most recognizable symbols, religious symbols, mathematical. I mean, the breadth and scope of the actual designs, some of them far exceed our science, you know, and our math, or they point to higher levels of math and science and stuff. And like I said, religious and spiritual symbols. So there's just such a treasure trove of inspiration in you know, and learning about, and just and then just looking at them, that they usually have a vibe to them. It's just so cool. So I don't know, I used to actually want to take it a step further and become one of those sort of crop circle enthusiasts and put together slideshows and like run around whoever would listen and, you know, deliver lectures or whatever.
Yeah,
just to kind of be a part of it. And I was getting close. I don't know, I was getting not totally set up for it, but I was steeped in it, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then I come here and like nobody cares. So it's like, well, okay, what else should I do? Oh, maybe I'll play a wedding.
Yeah. Crop circles or wedding?
Wedding singer. Okay. And worked at Saks, Thrift Avenue for my third time, you know. Yeah. What's interesting is like the leading theory about the crop circles and how they're created is actually not some kind of, they're actually, and there's some video out there, I guess, but, or at least eyewitnessing, of these, what they call BALs, ball, or BOLs, balls of light, about football shape. They just sort of appear, and they, you know, a few or one or two or three or four, whatever it takes, they move pretty quick, you know, usually at night when no one's looking, usually, and they zoom around a field pretty quick. And basically using kind of a microwave energy that loosens up the crop. You speak of water, you know, crop is full of water, so sort of irradiates it enough to be pliable and kind of loose. And then somehow they organize it with like a push, a wind or something, and into the shapes and then disappear, you know. So that's why no one sees like tracks coming in or broken stalks on the, you know, authentic ones. And it's like overnight. In other words, farmer went to bed, woke up next morning, and suddenly there's like this big giant design. And wow. It's not like some like insect skeletal alien thing with a big craft, you know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's less physical.
Yeah. Less. And so.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Have you had a major failure in your life that you can think of?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't look at life like that. I kind of. It's not that I want to sound like philosophical or anything. I'm sure there's been times when I felt like that, but I guess I just don't dwell on anything that feels like failure or like a stuck regret or anything. You know, I'm sure there's still things that I wish I'd done different or said different, but yeah, so far, no. I remember like growing up when, you know, I was playing with fire and a blowtorch actually, and you know, and my friend and I were like, oh, the parents are gone. We're like, putting like kerosene on a skateboard and lighting on fire and doing some like tricks and stuff, or, you know, just horsing around. It's all innocent fun, but you know, then we were carving our names with the blowtorch in my dad's wood pile in the back. And then we were off to watch Monty Python up at his house, and those carvings in the wood pile smoldered. And next thing I know, his stepdad's like, walks down the stairs and he's like, oh, Monty Python, that's a funny movie. Hey, Chris, your house is on fire. I'm like, ha, 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 you're funny too. And, no, I'm serious. There's like fire trucks down the street. You better go. So I had to call my parents, and that was the heaviest phone ever. Like, they're out of town. I'm calling my dad. Dad, it's okay. Nothing quite burned down, but, you know, here's what happened. That was like a failure. It was like a big regret.
Yeah.
And then he turned it around, and people would ask him, hey, you know, what happened to your house? You know, was it your son? He'd be like, yeah, it was arson. It was arson. So, you know, he forgave me after a week or two of don't go play with that kid anymore and don't touch my blowtorch.
Did you tell him right away? Were you like, it was me and we were playing?
Oh,
this
yeah.
is what happened? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. No. And the babysitter was there, and I guess she wasn't watching. Maybe that's her big failure.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe that's her failure. That's awesome. What a great story.
Yeah, but thankfully everything worked out.
What do you see in your future?
Yeah. Well, what I see or what I want to see, I guess that can be the same thing. I'd like to see, you know, improvements with my studio, like in terms of sort of equipment and, 'cause I'm kind of a self-taught, self-trained with plenty of mentorship, but, there's some, you know, gear stuff that, you know, I would love to improve upon. It's been long enough that, you know, it's getting near time. So a new sort of phase with my production work would be great. And, you know, maybe attracting more sort of ideal the kind, you know, the kinds of clients that I like to, the projects I like to work on the most are singer-songwriters like myself doing those. But then balancing out the work life with the studio life with more new music, mm-hmm. you know, it's high time for a new, fresh go at writing and performing, and I'm not sure how that's going to look, but it could include sort of a mix of Story Hill solo stuff and maybe band stuff, you know, and a little more touring. Yeah. And then at my age, I'm like looking at getting more into just health in general. So 10 years ago or something, I took a class in Qigong. Mm-hmm. And loved it. And then just last year I did it again. I was like, God, I love this stuff. So I've been trying to, and there's only one Qigong instructor in town that I know of, and he just does them seasonally, mm-hmm. which is great, but it's like I want to be more involved in sort of a healing arts, martial art thing. Nice. You know, something that's sort of self-discipline, but that and herbs and nutrition, where my wife and I are pretty into, just doing what's best for, like we have a son with asthma and all these allergies and stuff. So we're constantly looking for ways to help him alleviate a lot of, you know, his environmental stresses. And then just for our own selves, it's fun to learn more about what kinds of herbs you take during which seasons and stuff. Yeah. So, yeah. And, you know, I don't know if that'll lead to other career opportunities or not, but I'm kind of open to it.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have to just be music or studio work.
Nice. You mentioned some health things.
Yeah. Well, I feel super lucky and, like, I got led to an opportunity that maybe a lot of people don't get. I'm pretty young, you know, for people to have like a cancer scare kind of thing. And when I think about the lifestyle I was leading, it kind of makes sense. Over time, I was sort of a junk food junkie for years on the road, and then even up, you know, off, just have been, I mean, just fast food and, you know, just diet stuff that just was like really kind of toxic over time. But anyway, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, which, you know, kind of runs in the family, but also from what I understand, I've heard that, you know, genetics can play a role, but also it can just, anyone can have that happen,
right.
You know, and I didn't know anything about it a little over a year ago. And what happened was I was in a car wreck, my son and I, and that led to a visit to my general practitioner. And my wife suggested, you know, why don't you get your blood tested too? And, you know, you're not too young. Why don't you have your PSA checked, which is a prostate indicator. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm like, what's that? PSA? Okay, sure. And then the funny thing is my doctor forgot. And so I had to like remind him. And he's like, oh, okay, yeah, sure. I just thought you were too young, but whatever. Yeah, we'll do it. Anyway, it lucked out. And then he saw the number. He's like, oh, you better go to so-and-so. You know, and they will know what to do next. And that led to further testing, a little unpleasant to describe, but, you know, and that led to a diagnosis, which was the scariest or just the most depressing kind of, you know, few seconds of processing that I've had to deal with, as far as like somebody sitting across from me with a computer screen and a white, you know, coat explaining, you know, the bad news to me, for my bad news,
yeah.
You know, But for him, it was like, and the good news is we can take care of this. You know, we got knives, we got lasers, we got all kinds of stuff. You know, actually, he's like, yeah, I know this is it's kind of borderline. We caught it just in time, but we do recommend, you know, treatment. And I was just like, okay. So I felt really, you know, afraid and tons of fear and just like, wow, what's this, you know? And I got really depressed for a little while, a couple months. But what I did get too was really in touch with my feelings about the whole thing. And in that process was able to kind of open up to some people. And I was starting to be like, you know, I really, if there's any way that I could get this taken care of in some other way, you know, that's not as invasive. I didn't feel like I wanted to do either of the conventional options, mm-hmm. you know, and they both sounded just really unappealing.
Yeah.
So the quick of it is that, you know, sort of like 6 degrees of separation. I talked to, the car wreck led to a chiropractic, real open-minded chiropractor guy. I share, you know, he's a guy, he knows about, you know, health and medical stuff. And mm-hmm. so I'm sharing this with him. He's like, well, he agreed with me, if you can find any other way. So there's some reinforcement there. Meanwhile, I'm not telling anyone except my wife, you know, I'm just like, let's keep this. I didn't want to worry my parents or even get them involved.
Yeah.
You know, just, I was being very deliberate. And because I didn't know the answer yet. And the chiropractor led me to a massage therapist, medical massage, who, again, was really open-minded. And she's really aware of all the options in the medical community that aren't necessarily, like, I'd never heard of what a naturopath does or is. And so I'm at some point, you know, I'm just like, laying on the massage table, you know, and we're talking like spine damage and, you know, quite a bit of tissue stuff from whiplash.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I was in the ER with 5 stitches and like a swollen eye, like a shut eye. Yeah, it looked a lot better this year. But it was traumatic. Near blackout. And it wasn't even, it was just the woman behind me, the car behind us. And we were just starting to go out onto a road, and we just got rammed with this giant truck, and then she accelerated instead of stopping. It was just the weirdest thing. It was up a Bridger.
Wow.
So it's been over a year. I'm thankful to be alive, but, you know, still kind of like dealing with legal stuff with that, because insurance kind of, they wanted to, you know, settle it. Really early.
Right.
I'm like, that's not right. I'm not back to normal. I'm not whole.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I don't know. It actually went pretty easy, you know, all things told. But we'll see. I mean, one day at a time. But yeah.
God, that's amazing. Well, Chris, I want to thank you so much for being a part of this project. I want to thank you for being so open-hearted and for your humility. And for creating genuine and sincere art and always supporting very unselfishly others who are doing the same. And I just want to wish you and your family nothing but the best.
All right. Well, thank you for this opportunity, Steve.
Thanks, man.
Yeah.